You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn and Ty Genwright.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's news agenda with Samira Shackle. Samira, what do you have for us?
We're going to be talking about the Ukrainian student who's pleaded guilty to a series of mosque bombings, about allegations that the US has been spying on France, and about Saudi Arabia's terrible human rights record.
More from Samira shortly. Also ahead on the programme, we'll be in Jerusalem ahead of its mayoral vote, which has posed the stark question, will the contested city ever have an Arab mayor?
Also ahead. From one of the few to leave their homeland, American abroad Todd McEwen joins us later to discuss his new book, How Not to Be an American.
And before the end of the programme, we'll take a sneak peek behind the scenes of some of Lisbon's secret architectural gems.
Some people attracted by only palaces and others only contemporary architecture. And Lisbon is really nice because it has all those layers. It has all those layers since, I don't know, 12th century till nowadays.
All that, and we'll play some music too, coming up in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy Tuesday edition of the programme, but before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the world headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. A state of emergency is in place in the Australian state of New South Wales, where more than 60 bushfires are still burning, over a dozen of them out of control. One of the worst hit areas has been the Blue Mountains, around 40 miles west of Sydney. Many homes have already been destroyed and residents fear there could be worse to come. Reinforcement firefighters are being brought in from across the country as weather forecasters are warning that conditions could get worse with high temperatures and strong winds. Shane Fitzsimmons is the Commissioner of the Rural Fire Service.
Already the winds are problematic enough through the Blue Mountains. We've already experienced associated with this storm cell a 70 kilometre hour gust of winds and a little higher. That's about to come across towards the fire ground. That will present challenges in terms of the weather systems, erratic weather systems, and erratic weather behaviour at the local level. That then translates to very dangerous, very difficult fire behaviour and firefighting conditions.
A report by Human Rights Watch says US missile strikes, including armed drone attacks, have killed dozens of civilians in Yemen. The report says 57 civilians were among 82 people killed in six attacks which haven't been acknowledged by the US. Human Rights Watch says the attacks may have violated international law. And a separate investigation by Amnesty International has found that US drone strikes in the North Waziristan region of Pakistan killed a grandmother and 18 civilian labourers last year. A prayer vigil has been held for the victims and families involved in Monday's fatal shooting at a middle school in Nevada. A 12-year-old student armed with a handgun shot and killed a teacher. He then wounded two classmates before killing himself at his middle school before classes began in a town near Reno. The teacher has been identified by local media as Michael Lansbury, a former member of the Nevada Air National Guard. The European Union Foreign Ministers' meeting in Luxembourg ended last night with no clear solution over the issue of the jailed Ukrainian ex-Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. Ministers urged Kiev to move quickly to resolve the issue before the EU decides whether to sign a landmark trade deal with Kiev. At the final news conference, EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton asserted that Ukraine should do more work to address the gaps in its justice system in order to take a step closer to the EU.
The issue of selective justice, and Yulia Tymoshenko would say this if she were here, is a broader question about the nature of the justice system that operates in Ukraine. And we have been consistent in saying that this needs to be addressed as part of their desire to have a stronger relationship. I'm not going to get into the detail of that for the obvious reasons that as we get closer, a lot of discussion is going on and we will see what happens.
President Obama has declared himself frustrated with the malfunctioning website that's central to his signature healthcare law. He's also vowed to take steps to fix it. Scrambling to get ahead of a burgeoning political uproar over implementation of the Affordable Care Act, the president took to the White House Rose Garden to insist the law was bigger than just a website and that eventually the bugs in the software would get worked out.
The product, the health insurance, is good. The prices are good. It is a good deal. People don't just want it, they're showing up to buy it. Nobody's madder than me about the fact that the website isn't working as well as it should, which means it's going to get fixed. And in the meantime, you can bypass the website and apply by phone or in person. So don't let problems with the website deter you from signing up.
Starbucks have been criticized for allegedly charging higher prices in China than they do in other major markets. A report on official Chinese TV claimed that a medium-sized latte in Beijing costs about a third more than in Chicago. Starbucks says its prices reflect higher food and logistical costs in China. But the director of the Coffee Association of Shanghai said Starbucks can charge high prices mainly because of the blind faith of local consumers in it and other Western brands. The Chinese media have been scrutinizing foreign companies, and earlier this year, Apple and Nestle were pressured to review prices and customer service in China. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Barney Burnham, thank you very much. Maybe we need to introduce the Monocle Cafe to Shanghai
expansion,
and Beijing.
Chinese expansion.
Absolutely. Next on our campaign of global domination.
There's got to be tea there.
You would think all the tea in China, yeah. You know, it must be fairly cheap.
I'll have a brand steamer, please.
Lovely stuff. The time is 6 minutes past eight. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. Now, as usual, we start today's show by setting the day's agenda. And joining us today is journalist Samira Shackle. Samira, many thanks for coming into
Hi.
The studio and joining us on the program. Let's begin with a very interesting story that coincides very well with this report that was released by some British senior security officials saying that this threat of lone wolf terrorists is extremely high here in the UK. Tell us what you can about also this case with the Ukrainian man.
In the aftermath of the Woolwich killings, there was a huge rise in attacks on mosques. This was probably the most extreme version, which was a 25-year-old Ukrainian student, Pavlo Lapshin, who planted petrol bombs and exploded them outside three mosques in the Midlands and the north of the country. He's pleaded guilty to that. He's also pleaded guilty to stabbing to death an 82-year-old grandfather, Mohammed Salim, in Birmingham. And he's explicitly said that his aim was to start a racial war on the streets of England. He began this campaign sort of 5 days after arriving in the country. And as you say, the evidence seems to be that he's a lone wolf. So there's been no links found to any far-right groups in the UK or in the Ukraine or anywhere else in Europe, in fact. But he has explicitly stated his aim as racial hatred.
His campaign started, if you want to call it a campaign, shortly after that murder of the British soldier Lee Rigby in the London suburb of Woolwich. But this guy had form. He was a long time extremist.
Absolutely. And he'd actually, he'd committed his own brutal stabbing 2 weeks before Lee Rigby was killed. So his targeting of institutions came after the killing of the soldier, but he'd done a sort of very similar crime himself before that.
But do we have any indication why he decided to leave the Ukraine and then come to the UK to carry out these attacks?
No, absolutely not. It's a very strange case. I actually interviewed some of the proprietors of the mosques recently, and they were all expressing the same thing, sort of, why would someone come here and do that? And he was actually on a very prestigious PhD program. He didn't have much of a criminal record. I don't think everyone's expressed surprise. He was quite a quiet student. So it's quite peculiar the details of the case.
And, you know, we've seen a lot of attacks, as you say, on mosques here in the UK in recent months since Lee Rigby's killing. But this one came close to being an awful lot, or one of his attacks came close to being an awful lot more serious. There was a nail bomb. Mm. And were it not for the fact that prayers were an hour later than normal, this nail bomb would have killed an awful lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's quite frightening, actually. As you say, the impact was so strong that nails were embedded into the tree trunks around. It's just lucky that prayers were delayed. I think some of the other bombs, I think the one in Walsall that he also planted, happened to be a little bit far away from the mosque. So again, people attending the mosque weren't affected, but it really could have been a lot worse. Could have been a real bloodbath.
And yeah. Another story, which is really dominating the press this morning, Samira, fascinating story. The NSA snooping scandal continues. It deepens for the US. It's a very embarrassing situation for them. And now it looks like the French have also been targets of the NSA.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the gift that keeps on giving. It's been rolling on for a long time. As you said, the latest allegations published in Le Monde newspaper in France are that the US has been intercepting emails and phone calls in France. So that's quite a violation of sovereignty. Apparently, in one 30-day period last year, more than 70 million phone calls were intercepted. It's really quite mind-blowing. And that's automatic recording of conversations, also scooping up text messages with certain words, which, you know, the goal is to target terrorists, but according to the reports, they're actually getting sort of politicians and business people and actually members of the administration. So it's quite astonishing.
Isn't the NSA just doing its job, though? I mean, I'm surprised that there isn't a country or wouldn't be a country on earth that it's not spying on.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably true. But I think the question, and actually this is something that the White House has said in their statement yesterday, responding to French anger. They said that they're sort of reviewing their security procedures to balance security concerns with privacy concerns. And that's an issue for its own citizens. But I think once you're going over borders and into other countries, it's quite a violation of privacy. It's something that needs to be worked out.
I think what's actually absolutely fascinating is just the number, that 70 million intercepts. So it doesn't seem like the NSA were really targeting anyone specific. They had actual sources or potential targets that they were looking into. It just seems like it was a mass surveillance operation across the entire country.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. And quite an interesting aside in a lot of the reports is that it says sort of France is the worst country, is the sort of the most NSA intercepts except in Europe, except for the UK and Germany. So it's even more than that probably in here and in Germany. And as you say, it's just the sheer volume of it. I mean, it's hard to believe that that's targeted in any way around any words. It's one thing if you're spying on specific individuals, but just huge swathes of the population. It's also worth noting that the French government's been accused of a very similar surveillance operation of its own citizens.
Yeah, I mean, do you get a slight sense of feigned indignation and hoping that the French people will suddenly start attacking, tackling the US over its spying? Because as you point out, the French have been spying on their own people. Yeah. And that's come to light in the last week or so.
I mean, I think that there is an element, certainly, of that sort of mentality, well, I can do it, but you can't do it. Sort of, I can be rude about my parents, but you can't be rude about them. but I think, and so, you know, there is this issue. There's often been this sort of cockfighting and rhetorical cockfighting between the US and France on sovereignty. So I think there's that to bear in mind. But yes, I think there certainly is an element of this sort of being for public benefit, for show. And that was certainly the case with the first NSA revelations about the US spying on its allies. There's a lot of indignation, but not much sort of in any genuine way, I don't think.
And Samira, another story which you've highlighted for us, a very fascinating one as well. Of course, just a little while ago, Saudi Arabia really shocked diplomatic onlookers by snubbing a seat at the UN Security Council. Mm-hmm. And now a new report from the UN criticizing Saudi Arabia for its human rights record.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's no surprise that Saudi Arabia has a shoddy human rights record, but This UN report and comments by Amnesty as well have highlighted that 4 years ago, Saudi Arabia agreed to a sort of UN survey of its human rights, and it agreed to all the proposals, which obviously it just hasn't stuck to at all. So Amnesty has highlighted arbitrary arrests, detentions, torture, and a huge upsurge in all of this after the Arab Spring in 2011, which sort of frightened the Saudi government. And in one case, two peaceful activists whose main crime was, I think, tweeting about human rights had been sentenced to respectively 10 and 11 years in prison. And a lot of these a lot of these trials rely entirely on confessions which are obtained through torture. So it's really not a good situation.
But interesting, you know, some of the news we've been hearing out of Saudi in the last couple of weeks has been, albeit a small topic, you know, allowing women to drive.
Yeah.
I just wonder how you think that fits into that general kind of pace of social change there, if there is even any movement in it at all.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's very significant for women. And interestingly, the UN, the Saudi representative to the UN defending this human rights record thing says that there was tangible progress every day. And one of the things he highlighted was that now for the first time ever, 20% of the Shura Council must be made up of women. So that is very significant. It's not to be laughed at. But I think while there may be tentative steps forward for women's rights, there's a huge step backwards for political freedom.
Interesting, though, as well, the way that you say the UN ambassador characterised it as progress, almost an acknowledgement that, you know, they know they have an awful long way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, they accepted those the terms, the proposals that were given to them by the UN 4 years ago, and they don't seem to have acted on any of them. There's been small steps forward on women's rights, as you said. I mean, women being able to drive, that's going to make a huge difference to many lives. But but I think these clampdowns on political activists are, that was not something that the UN ambassador made reference to.
Indeed. Okay. Yeah. Samira Shackel, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be turning our gaze to Israel, whose citizens go to the polls today.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Monocle's latest collaboration with Comme des Garçons results in a light, energizing and refreshing unisex perfume, titled and inspired by Japanese cedar Sugi. It has top notes of Mediterranean cypress and pepper from Madagascar, a hint of iris from Florence, and cedar from Virginia. With a bottle designed by Monocle's own designers, Scent 3, Sugi, is the long-awaited addition to Monocle's fragrance collection. Available in all five Monocle shops, Dover Street Market in London and Tokyo, and of course, online at monocle.com/shop.
Welcome back to Midori House with Phil Han and me, Tig Enright. Israelis are voting today in local elections, but in Jerusalem, not everyone is taking part. Many Arab residents in the mainly Arab East Jerusalem are staying home, encouraged by Palestinian political leaders who took out newspaper ads saying they should boycott the ballot.
They argue voting means turning a blind eye to Israel's occupation of the city, and that even if they do go to the polling booths, it won't make any difference because the council's biased in favour of Jewish residents who mostly live in the West. Well, this apathy has sparked criticism from both Israeli politicians as well as young East Jerusalemites who are starting to see the benefits of making themselves heard. Marika Peters, Monocle's woman in Jerusalem, filed this report.
Deputy Mayor Naomi Zohr's campaign headquarters in Jerusalem's leafy Ein Kerem neighbourhood is a hive of activity. Campaigners walk around with phones clamped to their ears while their colleagues do canvassing across the city. The quiet gardens are whirled away from the chaotic streets of East Jerusalem, which have proved the biggest battleground for those in this election trying to get the attention of the 40% of Arab Israelis here. And while some candidates have chosen not to focus on this huge minority, others know they ignore them at their peril, and Naomi is no exception.
There is no reason why there should not be an Arab mayor in Jerusalem. The system permits it.
But ask most residents in the east of the city about that system and they'll tell you it's skewed, favouring Jews over Arabs, West over East, and that they lost faith in it a long time ago. Arabs constitute more than a quarter of total voters, yet they feel invisible. Standing on a platform promoting the role of female politicians, Tsour recruited Orthodox candidates as well as two Arab women to stand alongside her, although both eventually dropped out of the race. While there's no rule against Jerusalem's Arab residents from standing, and they're all entitled to vote in these elections, those who've previously dared to do so have been ostracised by their communities, accused of endorsing Israel's control over the city it occupied in 1967. With the Palestinians still pushing for Jerusalem to be their capital in any future state, there's also been pressure from leaders in Ramallah on East Jerusalemites not to recognise the legitimacy of the Israeli council. But plenty of people say the boycott's doing more harm than good. And one of them is 23-year-old Ala Abed, who says the dire state of her neighbourhood was the reason she initially agreed to join Naomi Saw's list and stand as a candidate.
Really, the Arab side of the city is not as developed, not as neat, not as pretty, not as clean. We don't have the services, don't have no recycling bins, or we don't have parks. We have bad education system. A lot of services that Arab kids and Arab people need in East Jerusalem are not there.
On the streets of the Attor area, it's easy to understand what Allah means. I ask people if they're going to vote.
لمين الانتخابات؟ انتخابات لمين؟
مش لي أنت؟
لا. انتخابات لليهود. إحنا ممنوع ننتخب. إحنا معنا.
Who for? They're not for us. They're for the Jews. One man tells me. Ola, a teacher, says nobody here will vote. She points at skips overflowing with rubbish that clearly hasn't been collected in quite some time. You don't see that kind of thing in West Jerusalem, she says. At her school, they're missing seven teachers and there are 40 kids to a class. Back at her campaign headquarters, Naomi Saw insists the same services are provided across the city, saying it's up to the residents of East Jerusalem to demand the changes they want made.
We have to ask the leaders of the Arab neighbourhoods and the Palestinian Authority why the people of East Jerusalem are not being encouraged to engage in local politics. Anyone who knows anything about democracy knows that that is the way to make sure that the city's assets are properly shared.
However well-intentioned, though, her comments come across as somewhat naive, perhaps typical of West Jerusalemites who lament but see little of the daily misery experienced by their neighbours on the other side. Although rumours of death threats against Allah for daring to stand proved unfounded, she says she withdrew her candidacy after talking with family and friends. They weren't opposed to her standing per se, but worried the high-profile nature of the campaign would put her at risk. As one of the only Arab candidates in the whole race and a female, it was always going to be extremely difficult.
I knew that my image will be everywhere. I knew that, and that raised a lot of fears inside of me, and I was intimidated. I asked more family members, let's say, and they thought, well, everyone is boycotting. You cannot just go. It's risky for me to go there in public. Everyone will talk about it because it's different. And they thought I might be attacked, but not physically, attacked in the media or the people. I'll be an outcast, actually.
For now, this stigma seems almost impossible to overcome, particularly in the face of pressure from the Palestinian political establishment to continue the boycott. It's not unheard of for people to stand outside polling stations in East Jerusalem warning residents away. Here's Allah again.
We have no representative. We don't have anyone that will help us to make things better. But we are in Jerusalem, like you have to start thinking. I mean, for the time being, we have to do something about it. We live here anyways. We pay tax as well. You should feel like a citizen.
For this election, that means voting, which Allah says she will do along with a handful of her friends. And in the next 5 years, she'll think about standing again, she says, with other Arab residents who feel the same way she does, perhaps in an all-Arab party backed by local community leaders. That way, people might just start to feel emancipated. Will they get that mayor? Perhaps not, but at least they won't say they didn't do their best. For Monocle in Jerusalem, I'm Marika Peters.
And we'll be following up with our woman in Jerusalem, Marika Peters, once the results become a bit clearer later on today.
And you're welcome back to Midori House.
The time is 8:25 here in London. Now it's time to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Joining us on the line from the Polish capital is Gulliver Craig. Gulliver, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Shall we begin with a very interesting story out of Poland about emigration?
Yes, emigration is starting to go up again. The new official statistics are showing that the wave of emigration from Poland, which had kind of stopped, or the Poles had started to come back when the economic crisis hit in Western Europe in 2007-2008. But now more and more young Poles are traveling abroad to seek work again, mostly within the European Union. In fact, 2.13 million Poles are currently living outside Poland, and the record number was 2.27 million in 2007. So it looks like that record could be beaten again. And also, in the last 5 years, nearly 8,000 Poles got British citizenship, which takes them off the list of emigrants, as it were. So the real figures are even slightly higher than that. They're not all going to Britain so much anymore as it was a few years ago. Germany and Scandinavia are becoming more and more popular destinations. And another change is that it tends to be more and more educated young Polish people with better planned trips than it was a few years ago. Yesterday, I spoke to one girl who's leaving for Norway in 3 weeks, and she said, oh, it's not like in the old days when people would just head off to London with £100 in their pocket and hope for the best. Now people tend to target jobs that are going to be advancing them in their career and have plans about what they're going to do before they leave.
So they're better heeled emigrants. But, you know, yes. All this, you know, signs coming out of Poland is that that is an economy which is growing quite strongly, but not enough to keep its best and its brightest at home.
Apparently not. The thing is that by many yardsticks, Poland is basically richer now than it has ever been in its history, but it's still a long way off being as rich as Western European countries to which Poles can freely travel. Also, there's 13% unemployment in Poland, despite these many years of economic stability and growth. They haven't been able to beat down unemployment, and when people do have jobs, wages are still pretty low. The average wage is 866 euros a month in Poland, the minimum 370. Now, the cost of living here is obviously less than it is in England, for example, but it's not that much less. On those wages, it's harder and harder to make ends meet. And the clearest example of the result of this is that at the moment, 44% of Polish people between 25 and 34 years of age live with their parents.
But Gulliver, I'm guessing that this is having some very serious political consequences as well.
Well, the government is really, really unpopular. Yeah, more than three quarters of people surveyed in the last opinion poll said that they were unhappy with Prime Minister Donald Tusk and his centre-right government. But the opposition is really failing to provide any kind of credible alternative because, well, sorry to use such a word, but basically they're pretty bonkers. They keep returning to this obsession with the 2010 plane crash that killed the former president, Lech Kaczynski. The opposition Law and Justice Party seems to have various initiatives to promote other policies and alternatives to what the government's doing, and then they somehow don't prove that popular, and then they return with a new offensive of trying to say that this plane crash in 2010 was some kind of conspiracy and that Lech Kaczynski was murdered. Their evidence for that is extremely flimsy. Recently, there were revelations that undermined the opposition's committee of experts investigating the crash. It turned out that most of them weren't aviation experts at all. They were people who had other kinds of scientific qualifications. One of them also had to confess to lying in a very widely publicized interview. But they keep still sort of hammering this point. In fact, there's going to be another conference organized by the opposition about the Smolensk plane crash. It's coming up soon. And today's headlines have got the opposition party's spokesman bringing up this idea that how is it actually possible that this plane hit a birch tree, which is what the official version of events is, when on 9/11 planes hit buildings in the United States and brought down these huge towers. How could a birch tree bring down the plane? I mean, nearly 4 years after the event, he's suddenly kind of questioning the basic things that the original experts who investigated the crash are doing. So it doesn't do very much for the opposition's credibility. And the one thing that some polls are doing is turning much more to trade unions. In fact, the Solidarity Trade Union, which was the same one that brought down communism in the 1980s, is having a bit of a comeback, actually. It organized big demonstrations last month.
Gulliver Craig, many thanks for joining us on the program. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Monocle's correspondent in Warsaw, Gulliver Craig, many thanks for joining us on the program.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be going behind the scenes of some of Lisbon's unseen architectural gems.
Some people attracted by only palaces and others only contemporary architecture. And Lisbon is really nice because it has all those layers. It has all those layers since, I don't know, 12th century till nowadays.
First though, Barney Burnham has the news headlines.
Thanks, Tig. A state of emergency is in place in the Australian state of New South Wales, where more than 60 bushfires are still burning, over a dozen of them out of control. Reinforcement firefighters are being brought in from across the country as weather forecasters are warning that conditions could get worse with high temperatures and strong winds. A report by Human Rights Watch says US missile strikes, including armed drone attacks, have killed dozens of civilians in Yemen. The report says 57 civilians are among 82 people killed in six attacks which haven't been acknowledged by the US, but which Human Rights Watch say may have violated international law. A prayer vigil has been held for the victims and families involved in Monday's fatal shooting at a middle school in Nevada. A 12-year-old student armed with a handgun shot and killed a teacher and wounded two classmates shortly before classes began at the school in a town near Reno. The European Union foreign ministers' meeting in Luxembourg ended last night with no clear solution over the issue of the jailed Ukrainian ex-Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. Ministers have urged Kiev to move quickly to resolve the issue before the EU decides whether to sign a landmark trade deal with Kiev. Starbucks have been criticised for allegedly charging higher prices in China than they do in other major markets. A report on official Chinese TV claimed that a medium-sized latte in Beijing costs about a third more than in Chicago. Starbucks says its prices reflect higher food and logistical costs in China. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Barney Burnham, thanks for that. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tig Enright and Phil Han.
Now, earlier this month, Lisbon opened the doors to over 60 sites of architectural interest as part of its second Open House Weekend, an event that allows city dwellers to discover their buildings and neighbourhoods in a totally new way.
Well, as well as famous national institutions and protected monuments, Open House Lisboa unlocked some surprising spaces that attracted an unforeseen number of curious visitors. Simon Tarik goes for a wander for this week's edition of Section D.
Last year, an eerie harpsichord recital launched the first Lisbon Open House Weekend at the Grand Sinal do Cortes Palace. Originally belonging to 18th century Portuguese nobility, the palace has in its time housed royal Italian diplomats, a public primary school, and now the Lisbon Architecture Triennial headquarters. Now in its second year, the goal of Open House Lisbon has remained the same: to provide a unique citizen-led survey of urban experience by opening buildings across the city. Triennial Executive Director Manuel Henrique tells me why the Portuguese capital is so perfect for such an event.
Yes, we did want to have different layers of use and not having buildings by this contemporary architect and not others, you know. So we try to make that balance because the audience has to be attracted by all these places, and some people are attracted by only palaces and others only contemporary architecture. And Lisbon is really nice because it has all those layers. It has all those layers since, I don't know, 12th century till nowadays. And some buildings really have that in them.
You'd think it would be difficult getting 60 venues to open their doors for free to the general public, especially as Open House Lisbon has demands beyond just that and relies on volunteers. At the Royal Astronomy Observatory, we are taken up to the tower where an 18th century telescope sits in sunlit streams of dust. At MOOD, the Museum of Fashion and Design downtown, the vaults of the concrete brutalist building, formerly a bank, are open to the public for the first time. Patricia Marquez, Open House Lisbon coordinator, believes that the city has embraced the spirit of architectural access.
I think it's always a victory because you're always dealing with someone that has no reason to open their house and they do it freely. And even a museum or a place that usually does that, what we are asking is on that weekend you should propose something slightly different to visitors. And instead of showing them what you are exhibiting, you're showing the building. So it's always, that's really nice. And I think when the public really responds to that, as it did this year again, because we had a lot of public, it's really good to know that, okay, there's really people who are interested about this. And sometimes, for instance, at Carpe Diem this year, we weren't expecting a big crowd because the building is always open, so public can go there. But we had these guided tours about the building, and we talked about it, and by the end of one afternoon there were 800 people there. So it's really massive, and we had no idea of knowing this was going to happen. So every time we have new surprises.
One striking addition to the open house roster that you can get to by tram is Casa de Moeda, Portugal's former national mint and a modernist icon in terms of the country's public work schemes in the 1930s. The site, whose main entrance is marked by a play of volumes and coatings that differ to the rest of the rationalist interiors, is one of the favourites of architect and open house curatorial consultant Fernando Sanchez Salvador.
Casa de Moeda is a very singular building, projected by an ancient and very modern Portuguese architect, Jorge Segurado, and was the building where the money was kept. And so, with the big structure in the interior and very, very well done, very good materials, very well projected, the materials and the spaces are very, very qualified. And people don't know that space. The large people don't know. So I think it's a very interesting building to visit and to see. Lisboa, it's an amazing city. It's a very interesting city with space. When I speak about space, are qualified space not only projected by architects, but sometimes with people we don't know whom they are, or ancient places and spaces. So Lisboa has a quality very interesting, and most of the places we don't know because are not obvious, you understand? And so it's with that idea that opens the open house.
Though Lisbon's second open house is now over, it is clear that the city has plenty of urban wonders to explore before next year's offering. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Simon Tarek.
And if you want to hear more about Lisbon, then this week's Section D is also looking at the capital city's architecture, as well as reports from Toronto and New York. You can catch the premiere broadcast at 1900 hours London time this evening.
You're listening to Midori House, and after this, we'll hear the frustrations of an American abroad.
Do you ever survey a parade of shops and gathered locals and wonder why the scene is so inviting? Well, to find out, Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé ventured to Wilton Way, a small thoroughfare in East London's Hackney, to get a read on the ingredients that underpin a community.
In a former post office at number 67, Borough Wines is a perfect example of modern renewal born out of village ideals. The success of Muriel Châtel's Hackney Wine Shop is down to the daily engagement with the locals. In addition to the expertly chosen bottles on the shelves, Borough Wines provides a fill your bottle at the barrel service, offering simply one red, one white, and one rosé at a comforting price.
You can watch Tyler Brulé's Hackney Revival film in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's stop makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time it was seen with disdain, but over the years that culture had gotten so popular it's iconic now.
If we're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu, every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
And you're welcome back to Midori House. Now, Americans, listen up. For those of us who have lived far from home, the character of the country that bore us can become more pronounced, skewed even, as to bear little resemblance to the country we left behind.
Well, Ty, just for the record, I want to state that I am a proud Canadian, just
sure,
in case any
right.
of our listeners are confused out there.
Because most people differentiate.
Well, one American author, born in California, burnished, as he puts it, in New York, and resident of the Scottish capital, Edinburgh, for over 30 years, has decided to unpick his home country from afar. Well, I'm delighted to say that Todd McEwen, author of How Not to Be American, Misadventures in the Land of the Free, joins us now on the program. Welcome, Todd, to the show. I just want to begin by reading out a couple of these rules, perhaps, that you've put in your book. I eat hamburgers and watch TV and chew gum all day. I don't smoke or drink. You have to be nice to me, and if you're not, I'm going to shoot you. I want everyone to play my game, and I can't understand a word you say. Todd, tell us about this book.
This is that's from the first piece in the book, which is about, I guess it's about infantilization, something that I thought began during Reagan. I was, the Reagan years, I was sitting in a parking lot in a Walmart in Arizona, way up in the mountains, and I realized that everybody was starting to dress like children. And I thought, you know, what is happening here? Where are the grown-ups? And it's just gotten worse and worse. I think I talked there about how you can even see 40- or 50-year-old people wearing shorts and little silly hats on these scooters, folding scooters. This is no way for, you know, an important nation to act or, you know, or to look.
And is that when you think things started going wrong, in the 80s, Todd?
Oh, I think so. I mean, the origins of the book are back then, because I'd been in Britain for a long time, 10 years or so, and then I went back after Reagan had departed, and just thought that everything, he really just managed to wreck a lot of stuff. Things that had been pretty were ugly, and things that were nice didn't exist anymore, and he'd somehow managed to, as we all know, wreck the economy in some way that meant that everybody had to work 7 days a week, and it was sort of the end of family life.
Now, Todd, some of your fellow Americans, perhaps, that are listening in right now may be saying, you know, why are you hating on your country so much?
No, it's a kind of fondness, you know? I'm actually being very nice to them.
But, I mean, Todd, there's lots of different Americas, aren't there? You know, you've got the whole metro versus retro divide. You know, I've just been to New York a few weeks ago, and, yeah, I had a fantastic time. You know, it's where consumers go to heaven, really, isn't it?
New York is not America.
Right, okay. So where are you talking about?
Oh, I think I'm talking about, well, I grew up in California, so I'm talking about that. And California is culturally, a very middle western state. They used to call it the seacoast of Iowa. And it's also a very conservative state. And I saw, with the changing tax laws there and everything, I really just saw this wholesale abandonment of the idea of public services, schools, libraries, fire departments. They decided they didn't need them.
I mean, California sometimes from the outside looking in looks like one of the greatest places to live on earth. I mean, I have friends in California and I see their pictures on Facebook. They seem to live like this amazing existence. They party in great kind of bars. They go to, what's it called, Lake Desolation or something like that, all these amazing rural landscapes. And, you know, their style, they seem to have this kind of cross between all American, surfer and hipster, and it makes me feel very dowdy. I wonder, I mean, is that for real, or is that just Instagram is making it look very...
I don't know. What, do they... Are
they employed?
Yes, yes, they are gainfully employed.
They are, okay.
They seem to find a lot of time to enjoy themselves, though.
Right. Well, of course, it's easier. You have to admit that the weather is good. So it's easier to hop from your office into your car and drive up to ski, something like that.
And would you...
It's a little easier than it is here.
Todd, is this what you'd be calling in your book the curse of the sand people?
The sand people are... It's very interesting you picked up on that. The sand people are the exact opposite to the people you're describing. They're the people who have made themselves so very, very bland and sort of bleached clothing that they cannot be identified. You know, they think they're going to survive by blending into the wallpaper.
Todd, what are you trying to achieve with this book? Are you trying to give the rest of the world a giggle, or are you trying to kind of effect social change, hope that America will wake up?
Bit of both, I think. I do think that it is it's a serious book. There's some things that I wanted to get off my chest, things that I think are seriously wrong, and they haven't been helped. We haven't been able to claw much, social consciousness back since Reagan. Also, a lot of this stuff, the longer that I'm away from America, of course, it looks a bit more absurd and funny. And there's some things that I actually wrote this for a publishing company that decided they didn't, the previous publisher, didn't have the money to actually send me to America. So I had to make some of it up in a kind of James Thurber.
You might want to keep that to yourself.
Well, Todd, if you had to offer up your top three rules on how not to be American, what would they be?
Well, this is about being an outsider. I'd say... Don't learn to surf. That's very important.
To the Californians.
Don't listen to anything in school. Don't listen to anything anyone tells you in school. And don't allow yourself to become cultured in any way. Don't take piano lessons.
Goodness, my goodness. Well, scolding remarks there. Todd McEwen, author of How Not to Be an American, Misadventures in the Land of the Free. It's out now. Thank you very much for joining us, Todd.
So you can't be cultured, you can't be educated, and you're not allowed to enjoy the great outdoors.
I'm sure there's a lot of Americans spitting fire right now.
Well, time now for a quick song before we leaf through this morning's British Front Pages with Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. This is Sweet Babu and Let's Go Swimming Wild.
Sometimes comes great success. When I met you, Blooms, I knew that we could be friends. Yeah, we could be friends. Despite our size, I still like your smile and the way you like to categorize my life. Nice and tidy piles. So here's the deal, let's play Drover and drive away. Drive away until we both feel that salty breeze and we are both at ease. And let's go.
Yeah.
can say that I feel love. And I hope one day that I will be what you mean to me. Yeah, I will be electric light breeze. And I don't know much, and like you say, I don't like much. But I like the way that you categorize my life and always raise a smile. So let's go.
Was an ode to our Welsh producer, Thomas Lewis there. That was Sweet Babu and Let's Go Swimming Wild there.
Talking of swimming wild, Steve Bloomfield has been swimming wild through the front pages of the British papers this morning. How did you like that as a segue?
I wonder where you're going with that. Right.
I got there eventually, didn't I?
You did. So there's a few things that are on the front of pretty much every paper in the UK today. Obviously, there's a bit of chat about nuclear because yesterday was a big announcement that Britain is, for some reason, going to have a new nuclear power station. It's going to be built by the French and paid for by the Chinese.
But which is exactly the type of thing that Britons hate hearing.
Well, yes, it seems we've successive governments have seemed to have, in this country, have had an aversion to state-owned industries. But apparently now we do like state-owned industries so long as they're owned by a different state. Nuclear will reduce wind farm blight, says the Daily Telegraph. Trying to ramp up support for nuclear by slagging off wind farms, which they see as a blight.
As a blight.
The FT also has this as well. Coalition goes cold on lower bill claims as nuclear deal is sealed. They'd been, because the big story really with energy in the UK at the moment isn't about is it nuclear, is it wind, is it solar. But it's about the cost to you and I. And there's been a big, since the party political conferences back in September, Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, said, I will freeze prices if I get into power. And ever since then, all the big energy companies have put up their prices by about 10%, just highlighting how much of a problem this is.
But the other big issue is that for decades has been underinvestment in energy generation and the energy network, and suddenly Britain is playing catch up, and this nuclear scheme is being cooked up as a way of fast forwarding the process through that catch up to avoid blackouts, as one warning said, within 5 years.
Yeah, next winter there might be perhaps blackouts in parts of the country.
Yeah, supposedly. I'm always slightly wary of these warnings from energy companies that have an interest in saying we need to have more of these sorts of projects. And also, when you look at the subsidy that the British government is giving this project and you compare it to, you know, for example, there was a project to do a thing called the Severn Barrage, which is a hydroelectric plant down on the River Severn, which would require far less subsidy and is supposedly going to produce as much energy. But we've gone nuclear, so to speak. Two other stories make the front pages. One is this thing. Let's look at the Telegraph's write-up of this, because this is kind of indicative of the way the government thinks. Foreign patients cost £2 billion a year. There's apparently a type of person called a health tourist who comes to this country to use our wonderful NHS. God damn them, who do they think they are? And this is a huge problem, and it needs to be sorted out. The problem with this problem was that until today, no one could quite work out how much of a problem it was. The government couldn't give any figures. There were no facts to this as well. Given that the NHS budget is £110 billion, there'd been one figure saying that actually it was only £30 million was the cost, which £30 million on its own sounds quite a lot, but out of £110 billion,
it's infinitesimal.
That's, 0.2%, if that, or is it less than that? No, it's about 0.2%. Yeah. There we are.
I need a calculator.
Anyway, Jeremy Hunt, the health secretary, has come up with a new study saying it's up to around £2 billion a year. But let me just quote from this report. The report's authors say this about the report: it is based on incomplete data, sometimes of varying quality, and a large number of assumptions. So there we are.
And he's also saying that he could potentially, the NHS should start charging foreign nationals to use the NHS. Is that a real possibility here?
They're going to bring that legislation in. I mean, the problem is, of course, that lots of British people travel abroad and use their health services without being charged. So I think it's one of those things that's been ramped up. I'm afraid we're going to see a bit more of that as we head towards European elections. One other thing, front page of every paper has a picture of Ruby Tando, who is one of three women fighting for the Great British Bake Off crown. The Great British Bake Off, for those of you who haven't seen it, is a wonderfully British institution. It's a TV program about baking. They're all very nice. The judge is like, maybe better next time. And it's become pretty much an institution
it's
over
brilliant.
The last few years.
It really is. It is actually brilliant.
It really is. It really is. I haven't watched too much of this this series, but previous ones have been staples.
It says a lot about where my culinary, desires lie, that, compare it with MasterChef.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like, that looks like a nice joint of beef or whatever.
But you're never going to do it, though.
No, but when you look at the cakes, you just go, oh, good God, I want you.
And you think, oh, maybe I could make a chocolate eclair, which, you don't, if you're watching Strictly Come Dancing, you don't think, yeah, I could ballroom dance. If you're watching X Factor, you don't think, yeah, I can sing like her.
Is there some commentary to be given on the fact that the three finalists are women?
Possibly.
Well, a bit of controversy from, the French chef Raymond Blanc, who tweeted this yesterday. The
Great are you going to give away who won it?
Well, I'm not going to give out the end, but I'll say this. The Great British Bake Off, not much skills, female tears, and a winner who? X.
Yeah. Yeah, he almost gave it away, or perhaps did give it away. So it's been a bit of a fight. Raymond Blanc, of course, often is found over the road at Hardy's.
Is he?
Yeah, 20 yards away. There we are.
There you go.
It's always good to know.
Let's go there now. It's a bit early, though, really,
yeah.
Isn't it?
It's a bit early for Hardy's, but there we are. We brought it home. Great British Bake Off. 8 million people in Britain. We're watching it tonight. Those who don't really aren't British.
Excellent stuff, Steve. Thanks very much. Unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have for today's program. Thanks to our producer, Tom Lewis, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Andrea Aracon, and our studio manager was Bill Luti. Up next, after the news, is The Entrepreneur. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London, which I think is being presented by Steve.
It is, yes.
Well, Marcus Hippie and I will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Ty Genrice, it's goodbye and thank you for listening.
Hong Kong, Zürich, London.
Hong Kong, Zürich, London.
Essa é a Mônaco 24.
From London.
In London.
London, cara.
De Londres.
Esto es Mônaco 24.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.
It's 11 a.m. in Beirut, 10 a.m. in Berlin, 9 a.m. in London, 3 a.m. in Chicago. You're listening to Monocle 24. Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Firefighters in the Australian state of New South Wales have deliberately joined up two bushfires near the Blue Mountains as they battle to control blazes.